Hi everyone and welcome back to the Fowler Hour. Today I'm joined by UX designer Miriam Isaac, but before we get there, just a little bit of housekeeping today. Next month I'm going to be doing a $58 Design Cuts voucher gift card giveaway just for newsletter subscribers. So if you are interested in either reading the newsletter, being a part of the newsletter, and getting involved with the giveaway you're going to be doing in December, go to the first link down in the description of this podcast to sign up for it there. It's one email a week, it's straight to the point, no rubbish, just either thought processes I'm going through, something cool I found, or ideas to help you improve your creative process or your design business. So if you want to check that out and be part of the giveaway we're running in December, go to the first link down in the description, sign up for the email and make sure you confirm it. You need to check your spam filters sometimes to find the confirmation email, but make sure you confirm your subscription, otherwise you're not going to be part of the mailing list. So get on with that now, sign up for it, and you'll be seeing those giveaway emails in your inbox in the next couple of weeks. So let's get on to the show with Miriam, and hope you enjoy it. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fowler Hour. Today, I'm joined by the magnificent Miriam Isaac, all the way from Israel. How are you doing this morning, this lovely Wednesday morning, Miriam? Wednesday? It's Hi. Tuesday. What am I talking about? It's Tuesday. Oh, goodness me, we're off to a good start.
What a weird head.
Not attached to my body, apparently. So, how are we doing this morning, Miriam?
We're doing great, Connor. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
No worries. So, we briefly met, and I've seen your work around, but we briefly met at Front Row, the Pitch Proof Digital Conference recently. And after the discussions we had, I really wanted to bring Miriam on the show. Firstly, because I love hearing your voice and your laugh, Miriam. You're bright. It's lovely. It's a really nice, positive start to the day. But also because Miriam is a UX designer and I am regularly asked by you guys and I get DMs all the time on Instagram about what is UX design? Why is it different? What should I focus on? And where do I even start with it? And Miriam has been sharing some amazing content recently, not just through wireframes and showing the process, but really applying some of the laws and the really practical side of UX design into her content. So that's why I asked her to come on the show, to shed some light across that industry. But Miriam, for the people at home who might not even know who you are, can you give us a little bit of a background on who you are and where you've come from?
Hi, so okay, great. So, Miriam, hi everyone. And so funny how we met on Front Row, and then we were like, we have to stream live in front of 4,000 people.
Exactly, yeah, weird.
What's fun that? Anyhow, so yeah, I'm Miriam. I've been designing and creating for the web for the past 8 years. Started off as building websites for small businesses. Eventually, I started with in-house for a company, and during that period I saw the move from desktop and laptop to mobile design, and saw how we needed to get responsive. We needed to create a UX team, and you know, and I spent about 3 years creating a team and training up designers and developers in that field. And yeah, and then after leaving that, I've been interacting with the design community, which I guess brings me here today. So that's me.
That's awesome. So when you were training up other people and looking at how the digital landscape was changing, did you think we'd get as far as we are today? Or was it kind of, I'm going to jump on this now because I can see where this is going to go?
We had like no idea. All I knew was that we had desktop website, and I was like, guys, we've got to go mobile, we've got to make it responsive, which was a brand new term at that time. And my managers were like, Miriam, all our traffic comes through desktop. This mobile thing is a trend. And I was like, no.
When was this? What year was this?
2014.
Oh my god, that's not even that long ago.
I know, could you even imagine? So I actually made a business case how even desktop, even like landscape websites, also improved conversion by getting responsive as well. So once I won that project and I was given a budget and I had to make a team, and then yeah, we went responsive, and we put ourselves into a war room, we studied whatever we could, we went to whatever conference anyone was talking about responsive web design. It wasn't called UX at the time. And we you know, and we tested all our results and we made sure that we were following best practice, or even we were like making up best practice and testing that because we didn't know, no one knew.
Yeah, so you were kind of on the forefront of this as people were figuring out what they're going to call it.
Yeah, and I remember saying, and there was it was funny because in the company there was a bit of political debate around my title because we already had a design director. So I was like, I found this term UX online, and I was like, oh, can I have like UX manager? And they were like, yeah, fine. And nowadays that's like an amazing title, and I, in retrospect, that was such a good way to like brand myself in that large company.
What and a great thing to have on your CV.
Yeah. But no one, and at the time it was like, fine, you can have this abstract weird acronym title, no one cares.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it does sound like they were, you could have just been like, I'd like Dog Walker Jam Donut Designer as my title, and they probably would have said yes. But I think you made the right choice.
So in hindsight, yeah, I did like a little bit of research. So in hindsight, it was definitely a good decision. And it also, because it was so new, so when I came up the company, I was kind of branded as that UX person within this large network. And as you all know, you always, it's a small industry, so you always, you will continue working with people that you've worked for before. So that was a great, oh, you need UX? Oh, Mim's that person. That's how I became like the UX person in my community.
Yeah, and when, I'm just amazed that it was only 5 years ago, or almost 6 years ago, 2014. But the fact things have changed so drastically, and the fact that you've obviously gone and taken this upon yourself to learn these skills, to appreciate what's going to be changing, what's happening, many people wouldn't have even seen that coming. And I'm sure you saw many people get left behind as well.
Yeah, for sure. I was there, like, I was literally, like, running around the company thinking, yeah, you should join my team. this is a new thing. You've got to learn it. You know, I was like, let's get on Treehouse. Let's get on these trends. And some people were like, no, I'm quite happy, like, not doing that, you know.
It's kind of insane, really, to think that things have moved that quickly, and that since that kind of initial shift over to more responsive and mobile-based design, now there are designers out there preaching the word that you should start mobile and then build desktop backwards and that kind of stuff. And it's just, to think how the landscape has changed is kind of insane, really.
No, it's totally insane. It's so funny. Someone's actually just come to me with an app. They have to make it adaptable to desktop, and it's very funny doing the opposite way.
Yeah. And then you have the same in reverse as well, where you have I use a tool called Notion, which is web-based and desktop-based, and for their app they've just wrapped it and put it out on mobile, and I'm like, this doesn't work, like, it's just not responsive in any way. And yeah, that's a whole nother debate and fandangle thing I'm dealing with at the moment. But so when it comes to UX design, is there a way you can summarize what you do in a couple of sentences for the people at home who might not even really know what UX design is? Because as I said, I get questions like this all the time, which are, and I cannot definitively do it. So do you want to give me like a tagline I can throw at people?
Okay, you know what, Connor? I've actually been coming to this like realization recently, but also I want to mirror it with a branding expert because I see this comparison. So let's try this for a second.
Let's do it. Okay, go for it.
So okay, UX, right, that is the experience someone feels when interacting with a digital product. UX design is the process you use to create that user experience. UX designer is the designer who's been professionally trained and is paid to use that process to create the UX. And what I'm trying to do here is kind of mirror it to branding, because I find with UX, you've got a lot of different acronyms that get thrown around the place, you get a lot of little diagrams that get thrown around the place, and people think it's this black box of IA and CX and UI, and how does all that fall? But branding has something similar, where they have the logo and you have your business card and you have your signage and you have messaging and you have voice, right? So branding, right? So you would say the brand is the experience you feel when you interact with those, what's the word for it? Those com- the components of the
kind of the applications, the messaging, the products, even, or even just anything that's attached to the company often.
Right. So like, say like a Nike shoe, that experience I feel when I'm like picking up a Nike shoe, that's the brand.
Yes.
And then they've got the brand design, which is the process you use to create that brand experience, which is, you know, all those things like the logos and the signage and the voice and the pyramid and, you know, the brand ladder and all those different processes to get to the brand. And then you've got the brand designer, who is the person that is, you know, creating the assets for the brand. So I think, what do you think about that?
I think that makes sense. I think that's a really good way to break it down. I think obviously you can break it off into different sections from there. So you could go down to like the brand design portion, but then you could also split that off into strategy and all that other stuff too. But for the purposes of explaining it simply, having those three steps for the UX side is actually really a clear way of defining that. Because when you're talking about user experience, it, as you say, it can be just bombarded with keywords and jargon that people just don't understand. But the way you've put it is quite simple.
And I know this is actually not the intention of Don Norman. Don Norman's intention, that Don Norman's the person who actually created the term UX, his intention was that it was supposed to be the entire experience, including the phone, including the devices, including the computer itself. But the issue with that nowadays is that it has evolved and there are jobs out there calling for UX designers, right? That people now have to know, okay, there's a job description. And also when I enter into a job, I'm going to have to do a process. So for the purpose of people trying to get into UX, I think we just need to decomplicate it and say, okay, I know this wasn't the intention, but it's evolved and people now need to write job descriptions and people now need to know what their role is and how do I even get into UX. And I think we need to say that that the term is the term is therefore connotated with digital design. Mm.
Yeah, and I think that's also where when I see people online talking about UX design specifically, I often feel and see that there is such an overlap between people who believe UI and UX have to be done together, that you have to know both, that you have to know how to use digital tools to be a UX designer. Some people say you do. And the skill set doesn't seem to be defined. Obviously, you talk about the origins of UX and the kind of more all-encompassing perspective it has. But when it actually gets down to the nitty-gritty day-to-day, what do people actually really need to know to be working in UX?
Yes, I mean, if we don't define that, and we just be all fluffy and be like, UX is everything, which is true in the original sense of the term, you know, and sometimes when I do sit and I define it and I'll make these stories and I'll define it and I'll see how my audience, you know, feels about this, I'll get the off person going, no, UX is everything, you can't define it, it's too much. And I'm like, you know what, I'm sorry, but people have the title of UX designer. People have the title of brand designer. And a brand is an experience. It's not tangible. And the same with UX, it's not tangible. But you can still call yourself a brand designer. You still know how to become a brand designer. It's clear cut, you know. And I think now we need to start saying, okay, maybe this wasn't the intention, but this is how it's evolved. And this is how you can get into it. You know, and stop being so pompous, in my opinion.
Yeah. it does make sense, because if you think about brand design, specifically brand identity and the idea of, or the philosophy behind branding in general, that kind of intangible feeling or sensation you have or a consumer has with a brand, that's only really been around for like 100 years at most. You're talking post-World War II, moving through the 50s and 60s, before anyone really coined these terms in any capacity. Because people had companies, people had businesses, but until kind of you talk about Geismar and Chemayev, if that's how I pronounce his name correctly, but those guys who made the Chase Bank identity and all those big kind of mid-century identities, Paul Rand as well, these are the types of people who started to establish these points. And I bet you if you go and look at articles and newspaper clippings from the time, they would have been going through the same thing. There would have been the similar backlash on certain terms, on defining different things. And that was 50 years ago. So to think that 5 years in, or what, kind of 5 years into the term of UX, that you're having these problems, it makes sense that people are getting annoyed about this. But you'd think with the speed at which people can communicate with the internet that we'd be able to define this a little bit easier.
Yep, that's 100%. And I think it's definitely, you know, I mean, we can see even on what they call design Twitter. And I've just everything just...
what they call design Twitter.
No, but I've just started on Twitter.
That's going in the bio for this episode. Hashtag design Twitter. Excellent.
Because I just think it's such a funny... Because I was on Twitter like many years ago, and it was more... I remember being on Twitter, and it was more about you followed companies, and it was a very weird place. And now I've kind of... I don't know why I've restarted with Twitter, and it's very interesting, this design Twitter.
What are your thoughts on design Twitter then, Miriam? What's going on?
I mean, this is such an interesting community.
The sarcasm is strong.
You know, because I'm coming from, like, the Instagram is probably one of the first communities that I've really interacted with, like, design communities, and that has been a very lovely experience. Like, everyone's been very welcoming, and, everyone's very welcoming, accepting, and we're all like, yay, you have 10K, and yay, you have 5K, and yay, we love this place, right? Whereas design Twitter, I find if you put out opinions, and you're not like 100% correct, like you can be destroyed within minutes, and it's really hard. It's really horrible to watch. And even I think Internet Explorer just came out with a logo, so that's just very interesting to see that unfold on Twitter.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a recent topic that was released yesterday, I think. So Internet Explorer, just for people who are not sure, it's called Edge now, but they've changed their logo 4 times in the last decade-ish. And they've made it into this wave, and everyone's talking about it being like, oh, it looks like Firefox. And it's like, guys, get a grip. Like, if anything, it looks like the Breaker podcast app. And I people are like, oh, it looks like Firefox. And I'm like, no, it's almost identical with a gradient to the Breaker podcast app. But that's just the way these things are. Like, if you want to go really far with this conversation, you'll end up with the Facebook Libra currency logo, where the studio that made the logo and the other company and Facebook are getting sued for design infringement and bad practice and stuff. That's where design Twitter should be looking. They should be looking at like actual problems.
But, I didn't know this. Oh, is that what everyone's talking? Oh, I didn't even get it.
Which one? The Facebook thing?
The Facebook thing. I know there's a lot of hatred around Facebook in general and design Twitter.
So...
I wasn't quite sure.
Just to fill people in quickly on this, I've mentioned it a few times on Twitter, but there's a studio called, I don't want to slag them off too hard, but it's a studio in San Francisco, or was a studio, I don't know if they still exist, called Character, who created a app for a kind of teenager banking app, which was kind of touted as this really excellent tool for young people to get used to using money, et cetera, et cetera. And it's that circle with kind of the... what's the wiggly line symbol that escapes me now, but they made that in a couple years ago, and then they recently also worked with Facebook to make the Libra cryptocurrency logo, but the studio was the same studio, the same studio made both of them, and made the same or very very similar designs for two companies in the same industry, in the finance space. So the original company who had this banking app for young people has taken Facebook to court, and also the studio, for malpractice, basically, and poor practice. But that's the type of problem that when you talk about design Twitter, I'm like, yeah, that's design Twitter is just nonsense. This is like real world stuff. This is what we should be talking to people about, being like, right, well, this is why we have to define certain processes and certain practices, but to stop this kind of thing happening.
Yes, for sure, for sure. And it's just funny with IE, like, you just know they had to change their logo, they had to change their branding, because like it's got such a history, such baggage behind it. It just needs to just turn over a new leaf, and so let them be. And you know what? In 5 years' time, people are going to not connotate that with the old feelings anymore, and the new generation will come in and just see edge, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And when that comes to that perception, the perception of a brand is really interesting, because sometimes all it is just changing the logo and you can get away with it. But often there's a lot more to it, which is kind of where I think I'm always very intrigued by what you do as a job, because what you do has such an impact on the way people perceive and experience something. So you're kind of like, I don't know, it's an interesting way to think about it. You're kind of like the wizards, but in the background, like putting a little bit of magic here and a bit of magic there to improve something or make an experience more enjoyable for people, which is why I think I see UX as a bit of wizardry sometimes, because I just don't, it's not quite there for me.
It's funny because, as you know, like good design isn't seen. So a lot of our work, a lot of what I do for clients, and I try and educate my clients a lot in the process, because I can sense they're like, wow, why is it costing me so much money for this app that has a good user experience? I could do this. It feels intuitive, but there's so much that goes into it, and there's so much research that goes into it, and process and practice, that they don't necessarily, you know, realize why it's this price. So, and yeah, there's definitely that struggle of, because when it's bad, you know, it's really bad. You do, as you said, Notion is just a really bad experience. You can't put your finger on the who, what, where, and why, but we just know this is a bad experience or this is a bad brand, right? And but when it's a good user experience, it feels like, oh, it's always like this, you know?
Yeah, and when it comes to talking to your clients about this, or when people approach you to work with you, how do you go about bringing them onto that onboarding process for, we're going to be doing something that's a little bit intangible mixed with a bit of gut feeling, but I also have practiced this a lot and know what's the best outcome? It's kind of like brand strategy process is what I see the comparison between.
It's why I also like started writing on Instagram a lot about it, and on LinkedIn, because I'm showing people, like, especially when you're with UX laws, I like to do the examples, because I'm showing this is what it looks like before you apply the law, and this is what it looks like afterwards. And then, like, the after, you know, in comparison, of course, looks and feels a lot better. So it's a lot of explaining. I like to refer, when I get a client that comes through my Instagram or through my LinkedIn, and it's funny because they're like, I love your work, but I don't necessarily have that much UI work out there. So they must be talking about the UX, you know, writings and the wireframes. And it's funny how they refer to that as work. So therefore, someone's coming to you with this understanding that this is a long and even scientific process.
And with that scientific process, how do you bring it to a table to explain that? Because obviously you've just said they love your work, they love what you're doing, the content you're putting out there. But when it actually gets down to kind of the nitty gritty of signing them on, what's the best way that you can help them understand what's going on? Because I have this problem with explaining any kind of research to clients. They're like, oh, just make a logo. And I'm like, yeah, no. It doesn't work like that. So
yes, I do talk about my process. I say, first, you know, we do the research bit, we like, I'll ask them, we'll do discovery, I'll ask them I've got like a discovery questionnaire, which has like three different sides to it. It's the company, the user, and also the brand, if they have one or they want one, because that also has to be reflected in the UI at the end of the day. And then we'll do that first, and then I'll explain to them, then I'll ask them for like at least five names of users, because you need at least five. And sometimes the platforms, you do have these super users, and they're always great to interview. And I show them that I have sometimes in the presentation that I'll bring back to them, I'll show them the process and the timeline and how it all works and when they can expect certain deliverables and at what time and what point we're going to collaborate on the wireframes or on the concept or on the you know, informational architecture, so they can see there's a whole way of thinking behind it. And for sure, like, some people they don't value it, and you know, and try and either don't take on the job, or you kind of cut the contract, because what I do find happening 6 months down the line is they're frustrated with the process, and I'm trying to explain to them that we're not going to come to a good UX. And they're like, I don't understand, why don't you just do it? So those aren't clients you can't have a long-term relationship with. But then sometimes people have been burnt by working with designers who don't have a process, who have just taken someone's wireframes and made them into UI and said that I'm a UX designer, right? And they come to me and they're like, it doesn't work. So those are the highest value clients, because they understand that they need someone to go through a process with them.
And when those people have come to you and they've been burnt before, do you find it harder to explain what you do to them? Because obviously if you are... It's sometimes people have these poisons, don't they, that they carry around with them, or this baggage that they carry around with them from previous experiences. And to try and actually let them open up about it and overcome it with working with a new person is difficult.
So when I get these new people, they've generally done some research themselves, right? And they've probably either like found me or they've been referred to me, and they know that, you know, I will like sort it out for them.
So you're the saving grace, like,
because I usually, like, someone just came to me and they were like, we have this platform, we've got all these challenges we didn't foresee, we really need someone to just fix it. Like, these are the kind of clients that come to me, because they know that probably the higher range on the price line. So it's only after they've tried the cheaper route, they've seen it's not worked, and they've seen like, okay, UX is a real thing that we're really going to have to get someone for, and not just make wireframes and balsamic. No.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So how did you come about that idea then? Well, actually, let me rephrase that question. What do you think is important to build up that reputation? Obviously, you've been working in this industry since UX was coined, which is, again, only five-ish years ago, but you've been working in digital for a long time. So what do you think someone today, to kind of build up this reputation of someone who has this strong skill set, needs to do? How do they get that reputation that you have?
So I started off sharing results. Like, if I would say, do a redesign for an e-commerce website, and then they would see an uplift in revenue of the next 4 months, you know, an increase of like 150%, and I'll make sure to share that. I'll either share it on my website, or I'll share it on a blog post, or I'll share it on Instagram. And I found the numbers really speak. So if you know, if you're just starting, it's good to go back to your client 6 months later and be like, did you see any results? Did you see any results from our KPIs that we set? Did you? And put that on your LinkedIn. You can even put it, you know, the project that you do, you write your process, and then you can say resulted in increase in engagement, or increase in conversions, or increase in revenue. And that's how you start establishing yourself as someone who knows what they're doing, because you bring results.
And those results, as you say, are in the form of a KPI typically.
Yeah. Yeah, which you're usually set at the beginning. Like, I'll ask them, how do we measure for success? Okay, and also, you know, things like paint done for me, what does done look like? Or how would you say, you know, what does success mean to you? You know, and those, you know, you write down, you circle, and you make sure that you meet those KPIs.
KPIs are an interesting one, because I think there's not enough talk done about them, particularly in the brand and identity space, because it's much harder to find a KPI for identity work and branding work, because... As you said at the start, it's that gut feeling. But I can imagine with the UX side, and correct me if I'm wrong, that when you update or provide a new process or strategy to these clients, that it actually completely changes the way people view their business. And you can track that through time on the app, engagement, click-throughs, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, so I would say that, my opinion, web analytics, me, completely changed my career, because I remember before this point you couldn't measure what the in-house designers did, and it was I saw within companies it's very frustrating to manage a design team, because they don't have the same KPIs as other teams. They're not measurable. You can't measure them in sales, you can't measure them in, you know, how many email campaigns they make, or how many phone calls they answer, or how many lines of code they write. You can't measure designers in that way. Like, one page of design could take them 5 hours, and that's totally legitimate. you know, when tomorrow it could take them half an hour. It's very, the creative process is very unpredictable. But what I found when I started making my UX team, I wanted to get pay raises for them and I wanted to get more budget. I measured every single change I made on that website and I made a marker and I would share my A/B testing results with the entire company. So everyone could see that the work we did had measurable impact. So therefore, if I asked for more resources or I asked for more budget, I was granted it because it was seen that I would bring results. And I've taken that on a wider scale nowadays, that if I do work, if I do an app or I do, you know, I guess a website, and if I can measure it, you know, I'll measure it and I'll share that with the wider audience. And you could do that via case studies. You could do that on your own website, on your own portfolio. That's like 100% doable.
Yeah. And those KPIs are actual business language, aren't they?
Yeah, it'll be things like increased engagement or even just increase in revenue. Like I was working on a $40 million website, right? I honed in that the product page was the key customer journey point. And I worked hard on each component to see how I can improve the different parts of that page user experience wise. So say, for example, there was a subscribe and save radio button switch where you would toggle between the two radio buttons to and switch on subscribe and save, and the business saw that those that did sign up had a longer lifetime value to the company. So what I did was I took that gone and they said, what can I do to subscribe and save? And at the time, switch UIs were very new. And I used the switch UI and I created this very animated. And also I wanted to be so clear to the customer that you're turning this on, right? You're turning something on that will make, that is going to bill your account once a month, but you'll also be saving, you know, $5 every month, right? But before it wasn't this, it was literally, you see a small price change. You didn't know what happened. You weren't quite sure. So by doing that small UI change, and having this animated and also more communicative, so you also increase trust with the customer. You're not trying to hide that you've now signed up to be bold every month. And we saw maybe 25% increase in average order value, which actually translates to like $500,000 a year for the company because of the $40 million website. So when you work on that scale, your percentages can actually bring in very high revenue.
Well, especially when, from an outsider perspective, it might seem like you've not changed very much, but by honing in on, but do you understand what I'm saying? Like visually, yeah. Not a lot has changed. I mean, but the point of it in the skill of what you do is honing in to find what that is. It's the same story, which is kind of this, firstly, just to kind of summarize what you've said there, Miriam, I think a 25% increase in anything is incredible. So to be able to do what you have done and apply that to a website which has then made someone an extra $500,000 in revenue is insane.
Yeah, and then I can claim I'm not being paid enough.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the whole thing. And is this principle, I think I was looking through one of your posts and the story you just told kind of resonates with a post you made back in July about the Occam's razor principle. I think you've used a similar screen grab of what you've done by switching the subscribe and save from a button to a toggle switch.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I used that for, yeah.
Sure. So if you want to go and look at Miriam's, that particular principle that Miriam's just spoken about, I'll put the link to it in the description of this show so you can go and find that Instagram post. But the point I was just going to make is that there is a story about, it's kind of the story of a ship is broken in the yard and they go and hire someone who is young, they're cheap, and they just go in and they tap around the whole engine. They can't figure out what's going on. And they basically summarize by saying, I've spent all this week doing this and I can't figure out the problem. Pay me for what I've done and you'll have to find someone else. And then they go to someone who is 100 times more expensive and he walks up to the engine with a hammer, looks at it once, says, this is your problem, whacks it with a hammer, and it starts.
Yeah. That's for sure. It's about looking at the problem from like completely different perspective, because sometimes we can be so we can have tunnel vision, as we call it. We'll be so honed in into, say, you know what, we'll put these band-aids, we'll put on like an overlay, or we'll put on like a pop-up, or we'll put on maybe, oh, maybe if we put like, if we write a blog post about it or send out an email, maybe you just need to completely change the structure of the application or of the, you know, the website. It's not just we get so attached to band-aiding stuff because it's quicker and it's cheaper.
And when those people do band-aid stuff, they're the people who come to you like 6 months later, right? And they're like, Miriam, please save us.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, do you know what the really funny story is? That I was working for this large company, and I'm very much a fighter. So I would always fight a lot for the team and a lot for UX and a lot for good design. And, you know, I caused a bit of a ruckus. Let's face it.
I wouldn't expect anything less.
So I had to leave, right? Instead of them really dealing with what the problem was, right, and what we had the structural problems in the company within within selling of design work, which was they wanted someone else to sell the design work, and I was like, no, you need to have designers in meetings and front-facing meetings. And instead of really dealing with that problem and dealing with the ego issues around that, I actually ended up leaving because I couldn't deal with the political drama, and I was called a year later. After my manager was left the company, and I was called a year later to come back to the company, and I was like, ah, that's that on a really big scale.
Wow. I bet that made you feel really good about what you've been doing.
Yeah, that was amazing validation, because I felt at the time, also my whole team, they were also, everyone was, it was just a very upsetting time, and someone told me like this cloud went over all the desks of my team, because we'd been, you know, I'm quite crazy, so we would be in this fun team, like, but we also got results, and I think people didn't see past the laughter and the fun in the game, even though I did always publish our results. But I don't know, there was maybe like a preconception there, so I actually had to leave and stop everything I was doing for them to see the value of design.
You don't see it till it's gone. That's the rom-com motto, really, isn't it? You don't know what you've lost till it's gone. Yeah. And
yeah,
obviously, so go on.
That was huge validation, and it was just huge validation for my career in general, the path that I'd chosen. And I was like, yeah, you know, it has a design nowadays can have a big impact, and it is measurable, and you can see the difference. And sometimes, you know, say we're branding. A client might go on for years without a good brand because he thinks it's too expensive, or it's for luxury brands, or, you know, and then he'll one day, I don't know, make a decide to invest. And the difference he will see in revenue over the course of the next year will be mind blowing. And he'll be like, oh, well, it's such a shame you didn't do it earlier, you know?
Yeah, it's seeing the forest through the trees, isn't it? Until you have that bigger picture, or someone really points it out to you, or you lose something. You just won't know. But going back to your point that you made of you had a more positive team, it was bright and it was fun to work with the team. Do you think that corporate business and kind of more in-house agency type stuff is still focused on that kind of you got to be uptight and corporate level? Or do you think it's becoming a bit more relaxed now that the industry is kind of growing and recognizing the power of UX a bit more?
No, I still think that people, and I speak to a lot of people on a lot of my peers on Instagram about this, because it's funny, like, we've had the same experiences, even though we're across the globe.
Yeah.
That they've been part of these, because we had a whole, someone was writing about how now it's time for in-house teams and this trend of going in-house. And I'm like, we've actually already been there, right? And we've actually seen there's been so many problems. Designers are still undervalued. Designers are still not getting a seat at the table. You've got people like Stephen Gates who are, you know, talking at these large conferences, and he just sounds frustrated. And he's someone who has been evangelizing for in-house design teams for so many years, and he's still frustrated. And there's actually been, I've actually seen on Twitter, a call to go back to more of a consultancy style for design teams, because they're actually given more respect when they come in as consultants, you know, consult with the company, right? Go away, do all their craziness that no one can see, right? No one's looking at the crazy post-it notes and the crazy funness creative process. And they come back with the presentation, they present the the solution. And that's taken a lot more seriously than having this in-house team that other people in the company might be jealous of, or they might see they're having more fun than us, or oh, it's not fair, why can't I be involved in design? Or, you know, it's, or whatever these, you know, feelings that other people who aren't in creative feel. And no, it's not necessarily gotten better. And I think we may have to move back to the agency model.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few similar posts recently, and actually got a message from an agency on the West Coast in the States, basically saying, your portfolio is great, you should apply for a job. And I was like, yeah, that might be difficult. I'm in the UK, but okay. And they were basically touting and pushing the idea of being in-house. Like, the actual message was, we feel really strongly about working in-house. We've seen so many benefits from it, da-da-da-da-da. And, like, they were talking about it like it was uncommon. And I remember literally getting into kind of the more formal design industry, what, 3 or 4 years ago now, and seeing that the vast majority of people were largely in-house or working, say, as consultants in kind of this more semi-translucent design agency way, where they're in their PJs in their office, but they're wearing like a tux to a meeting. and now it's flipped back, and now it's going back around again. And I think people just don't really haven't really figured out how to make remote teams work effectively, like, because they're so new. But there are still so many problems with in-house, as you've said.
Yes. So, yeah, a lot of problems in-house and a lot of frustration. And, you know, especially nowadays, we're seeing this product manager and UX designer relationship, which is leaving a lot of people very frustrated. I mean, I got a message from a designer, Wayfair, is that how you say it? In the furniture company.
Yep.
So they actually sent me a message like, what is the definition between a product manager and a UX designer? And I said, do you know what the process is? You get the UX designer, product manager, and developer in a room. You sit down together and they can decide between themselves, yeah, what role they want to take on. Like adults should. But it's just, for me, it's mind-boggling, because I had a friend, just talked to a friend yesterday who got this new PM, and he's giving her wireframes, and she's really frustrated because that's not how you solve problems. And, you know, and people are like, well, how do we define it? We have to define it, you know. And now I'm thinking back to that, what I told this Wayfair designer, and I'm like, you know what, maybe someone should define this, because then people who are frustrated in these companies or frustrated working remote teams or whatever it is, they can have this to hark back to and benchmark against. I don't have the answer though.
Because that would be the question. The question would be, how would you define it? Who would make that choice?
Exactly. Like I would say the product manager though is responsible if the feature, right, is feasible and viable and cost effective to the business. It's like, okay, let's say, did you ever see this video of them making these like triple layer cakes? So like a product team is kind of like how you make one of these layered, you know, ice cream cakes, right? You've got, right, it's not like everyone's making the cake together, right? You have the designer who, because if you do all the layers at the same time together, right, you're going to have a big fat mess. So each one has to come in and do his role. So first you'll have like designer who will design the cake. Then you'll have the developer who will make the cake. And then you'll have the QA person that will taste if the cake tastes good. And then the product manager should be deciding, can the company even afford to make this cake in the first place? You know, and that's how product teams should function, more like a heist team. You know, have you ever watched Ocean's 11?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I see what the comparison is here, yeah.
So basically, you've got the person that Brad Pitt who does like logistics, and you've got George Clooney who plans everything, and you've got the guy who, you know, can bend into a fence, and you've got the person that can open the safe, right? What you do right at the beginning is you get together and you make the plan, right? And each person who specializes does their role. And if the person who's opening the safe, you don't disturb him, You know, you don't go, well, I think you should go this way. I think you should turn the knob that way. I think you should turn this way. You don't do that because you first of all, you've already got very limited time. And second of all, this guy knows what he's doing and you're not going to, you're going to ruin the whole heist, you know? So, and I think we've definitely got the term collaboration wrong in a lot of different ways. And this, and what happens is that we end up Frankensteining a lot.
Frankensteining, that's a good way to put it.
You know what I think is funny, and I know it might be controversial, but you know, there's a difference between InVision Studio and Figma, right? Figma is amazing. It's come out of nowhere, the software, and it's quickly gained traction within the design community, and everyone more or less have actually migrated to it. Except for like Adobe XD has been very clever though, because at first they were like not, they completely were losing up to Sketch, but they've actually turned things around for themselves. But we're not talking about XD right now, we're going to talk about Figma and Studio. Figma was created by a 23-year-old in his bedroom by himself with a friend who was a developer, right? Now, InVision Studio, you would think that a company that have this amount of data, that have these amazing designers and developers, they would create a solution for designers that would be, you know, 100% amazing and would have been completely accepted by the design community. But it wasn't. It was released early. It has a lot of bugs, has a lot of problems. It wasn't adopted by the community. And you know what I was thinking in hindsight? You know why? Because I bet on their product teams, they probably debated so much around this feature and that feature, and they wanted, this person came in and changed that and they collaborated on this and they did that, and it was probably like 10 people on the team, right? And it's very different to how InVision was made in the first place by one person, Clark Thalberg, right, who had this passion, who had this vision, right, and he executed on it. Very different to our in-house team that doesn't have such a goal. Whereas Figma, this guy was really just solving the problem of designers needing to collaborate in the browser in a design software. And he really did that. And it was only two of them. So I just think that's really interesting.
It's too many cooks, isn't it?
Yeah.
Too many cooks spoil it.
But then you've got these people who evangelize collaboration. And I think there's something wrong here. I don't have the answers, but I think there was something wrong here.
There are many different... I see exactly what you're saying. The whole heist thing makes sense. Collaboration works when you have specialists, or you at least have defined roles. But I think we're on the same page here, which is that you can collaborate with people, but it doesn't... If someone's just going to... It just reminds me of school projects. Like, where you'd be in school and I would be in English class or in biology or whatever, and it'd be five of us, and I would end up doing all the work, but everyone else thought they could do the work or wanted to have a say, but just chipped in bullshit.
Mm-hmm, 100%. There's always that person that stays late and just does everything.
That was me.
That was me as well. God,
where did those GCSEs get me? Nowhere.
No one asked me for my GCSE results. Like, hey, they were very good. And I did 11 of them.
Yeah, I think I can't remember how many I did, probably about the same. But just, it's that whole group project mentality of, oh, we are collaborating if we're all in the same room yelling at each other. Like, mm-hmm. No, it's not how it mm-hmm. works.
And also the problem is when the designer doesn't accept feedback or say pushes forward on how they think something should go, then they're seen as difficult or they're seen as uncollaborative. And I think that label hindrances so many designers, and they're very frustrated about it.
Do you see that more from a designer interacting with, say, as you say, like a product or project manager and or higher up more corporate senior level bosses? Or is it amongst the designers?
Yeah, and I think this also contributes towards working in corporate, because if you've got a non-design manager, right, because at one point the designer or the design manager is going to report into a regular manager, and this manager, he's like, move this thing here. And you know this is going to just ruin it. Like, even if you even try it, right, but you're like, you know what, this isn't going to work. I'm very sorry, I can't do this. He's not going to see that as your professional doing your job and advising him. he's seeing it as you are being insubordinate. And so many design leaders get on stage and they go, guys, you have to fight back. Guys, you've got to push back on design. You've got to, you know, get into the room, sit at the table and push forward, and otherwise we're going to end up with rubbish design. And you know what? That's sending so many designers down this road of being insubordinate, which is why you also get these apps that come out which look terrible. Because, you know, someone's been forced by their manager because they may have three kids at home or they can't lose his job, and they've been forced to make that decision. You know, so you have this, which is why I also think we've got to go back to the more agency contracting model, where the designer's coming in as professional. And they're not being insubordinate if they push back. They're being a good advisor. They're being a professional.
I agree. And I think there's, it does require a lot of empathy as well, because we see on, and I've seen a lot of this on Design Twitter, I follow Mike Montero, author of Ruined by Design and other similar books. I follow him, and his idea is this, as you say, this pushback, this unionization, the definition of these roles in kind of a law or like medical type way, where there is a board and you have specific training and or have to be registered to certain departments to be called a UX designer or called a brand designer, which in some respects does work, but there obviously has to be some empathy for people who are in these jobs who have other priorities. But at the end of the day, it's that toss-up. It's the toss-up between, do you make a choice that is potentially going to harm people with the design you do, or even just make a bad product? Or do you stand up to them as a potential to lose your job, which then means your family will suffer, or whoever's around you will suffer, which is like one extreme or the other. But I see what you're saying, and I see where people are trying to go. But it just seems like the amplification, especially through the internet, through Twitter and things like that, is making this problem less of a discussion and more of a, I'm putting my foot down unless you agree with me.
Can I say though, that's basically what I went through when I had to leave this company, because it got to the point when I was seen as so insubordinate and so like, oh, this designer, and then I'm pushing back and doing everything that my design leader told me, that, you know, I have four kids. At the time I had three kids. And, you know, and at the time I was facing, I mean, I got left, you know, I negotiated a good package and whatever it was, but that's still, you know, that's really what happens when you push back, right, too much. But even, it wasn't too much, because I was called, when I was, that phone call a year later, I was called because the design went down the drain. Because there was no one pushing back, and they just let, and everyone who kind of like, were against me kind of went into my design team and kind of took over and did whatever they wanted. And I was like, and I told the CEO, I was like, that's why I pushed back. That's why I projected the team. That's why I fought so hard. And he's like, I see that now, and we'll listen to you now, Miriam. But it took a year. And it took a year of me losing a secure job, right? Going to like a start, going to like a different job, I went to a startup, and them also losing a year of good design work.
And it's one of the things people say, you don't leave because of the job, you leave because of the people you work with and your boss, or whoever is not playing the game as they should do. And then to have that phone call, as you said, it must have felt extremely validating and empowering, but also a bit like a waste of time, I bet.
Yeah. It was such a shame that we couldn't, I remember trying to work it out within the people there, but the ego, you know, the egos and the insecurity. And, you know, I think I just responded to someone on Twitter, and I said, he was like, well, why is it that companies can't innovate? And I was like, it's insecurity floating down from management. That's the only reason why. Otherwise, it makes no sense for a company not to always be challenging themselves and their strategy. People are protecting their own jobs all the time. And this is why massive companies have been disruptive, massive companies have fallen, especially at this digital time and age. But as I said, Mike Montero, he's great. You know, he's fantastic. And I really, someone needs to be at that side of extreme. You need both sides to come to the middle. And he needs to be on that podium, on his side, preaching this, otherwise there's not going to be any change. I'm not saying, I don't think it's going to get to that point, but he will push the needle by being on that side of the, you know, of like, imagine like a scale, right? So for him to push the needle in the middle on the tug of war, he needs to be heavy and strong on his side. Otherwise, it's not going to move. I get it. Again, I get what he's doing and I get what he's saying, and he needs to be that. But we also, you know, I don't, as I said, I don't have the answers. And I think we need to be looking at the going back to an agency model or maybe pulling out in-house.
Yeah, and just to summarize, people listening at home, Mike Montero's book is Ruined by Design. I recommend listening to it on audio more so than reading it, because Mike's got a good way of putting things, his points across. It's about ethics and design and unionization and all that type of stuff, which is, say, as Miriam says, is one end of the scale. So to get that perspective, I think it's worth listening to. But if you had a magic wand, Miriam, what would you like to see in the next 5 years from either the corporate side or just from UX designers in general to make the industry more palatable to work in or more enjoyable?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I have to agree with you. Definitely listen to the audiobook. It's very good. Second of all, yeah, idealistically, if I had a magic wand, I would have it that executive management would understand the creative process, would value the creative process. I would understand that these designers aren't going to be measured against regular KPIs that you have in your company, and to you know, let them do their crazy thing in their room. But if they're providing results and if they're providing the design work, then why do you need to get involved, you know, and allowing that creativity to exist.
Excellent. Do you think an exploration more of that agency model will help as well for more people kind of striking out on their own?
So, like, if idealistically, if they're being happy, I do see the benefit of being able to run back and forth to, like, the development team and the QA team and getting things out fast and testing them. But I'm also seeing a negative side of Agile, which is people are getting things out too fast and breaking stuff.
Yeah, launching too early, not even having, like, a minimum viable. They're just pushing.
I was actually just, I worked for someone like a few months back, and I went into the company and I saw the brief and I saw what they'd already made, and I said, this is not going to work. You should drop this project. And they were like, no, but the development team have already invested all this time in it. Could you just make the UX work? And I was like, I really can't. It's really, this brief is wrong. This platform is wrong. You have to start from scratch if you want this to succeed. And they weren't listening, and I was already contracted, you know. So I tried my best, but it didn't work and it failed. And I remember sitting there, you know, when we were terminating the contract, and I was like, but I said, let's not do this. But it's a constant. And as much as the validating that I told you so moments, I also don't like it. I don't like having to sit there and be like, you know, this is wrong. But also, this company, I realized, didn't have any experience in releasing digital products and could have done well having that infrastructure before or having that kind of expertise. I don't know because I can't say in terms of if we should go agency, because I also see not when you're not in-house, you're less attached to the business and you might not, you know the goals as much and be more familiar with that. And sometimes what can happen with designers and agencies that it's like award unto itself, where they have their own awards and they have their own, you know, creative process, and it you know, and there's people who value work that's actually not real work and it actually never sees an actual piece of code, right? And it just stays on dribble, but it's not real work, you know? So I don't know. I don't have the answers for it. I'm sorry, Connor.
Well, no, it's good to hear though that you appreciate there is a spectrum of things that need to be done, or at least tried. Because many people wouldn't even be humble enough to say that's the case. You might have strong opinions about certain things, but in the side of this might work, this might not work, these are the problems, that's how things get solved. Because until people put all these cards out on the table, you can't see what actually is the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And it might take, you know, like a group of people to say, like, this is how we'll solve that. And that's really when collaboration does work. When you're right at the beginning, when you put the problems out on the table, and then you make a plan, and then each individual executes, you know, his part of that plan. And then you realign weekly, let's say. So that's the same. We've got all these problems in the industry, you know, and it might take a few of us to say, okay, this is what should be done, but couldn't tell you today, Connor.
Well, best you come back on in a year, and or maybe sooner, obviously, but in a year or 2 years, and then we'll see what's happened.
We'll just be maybe Twitter design
hopefully,
Twitter maybe went on fire.
Hopefully design Twitter's like died. It's one of those things that is like a hydra. You just cut off a head and another one grows. So thank you very much, Miriam, for coming on the podcast today. Where can people find you on the internet?
So I would say best places is probably Instagram and LinkedIn. I'm very good with responding to DMs on Instagram. So definitely you can reach out to me there.
Fabulous. All those links.
So Instagram handle is at misisaac85. And then on LinkedIn, just Miriam Isaac, you know, she'll come up. So.
Yeah, all those links are going to be down in the description for you guys, along with a couple of other links, including that Occam's Razor post as well. So thank you very much, Miriam, for coming on the show. If you're listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, guys, please leave us a 5-star review and or a comment about what you thought about this show. You can tag me about the show on Instagram stories at CFowlerDesign or using the hashtag FowlerHour on Twitter. We'll be posting about the show and future shows as and when they come out, so keep an eye on those feeds there. Thank you very much to Miriam, and we'll see you guys same time next week. Bye for now.